Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the movie geeks go inside the classic Gone with the Wind with acclaimed critics Molly Haskell and Michael Schregro. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
Thank you.
Ray can't go on accepting these gifts, though you are awfully kind.
I'm not kind. I'm just tempting you. I never give anything without expecting something in return. I always get paid.
If you think I'll marry you just to pay for the bonnet, I won't.
Don't flatter yourself. I'm not a marrying man.
Well, I won't kiss you for it either.
Open your eyes and look at me. No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Yeah, that's just one of the classic exchanges between Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, a movie that has lived, thrived for the past 70 years, and it's still worthy of discussion, as you'll find out during this next hour and a half or so of Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening.
And my name is Jerry, another one of your co-hosts this evening.
Hey, Jerry. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm very good. We don't do this very often. We've gone to, obviously, films of our childhood in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and the classics of that era. But I wanted to look even further back to some of the defining movies in motion picture history.
Right.
And Gone with the Wind, when you think about it, Gone with the Wind is still the most successful movie of all time, at least in terms of financial figures.
Yeah, nothing beats it. Adjusted for inflation, it is the highest grossing film. And, you know, it has everything going for it.
Yeah.
And it is timeless.
I think,
you know, watch it a lot. You know, for a long time, I didn't think there are any other films except for this and King Kong in the 70s. I had no idea there were other movies. I thought that these were the only two movies. Because Gone with the Wind was still playing and re-released when I was little. My parents, it was the first film my parents saw when they moved here from Philadelphia. They went up to, there used to be a theater right up the street, the Mercado, and they saw that and re-released. So for like the longest time, like Gone with the Wind, you thought, hey, this is the only movie that's ever been made.
Right, right. What's staggering about it is, I think I read somewhere that obviously the population was half of what it is now back
mm-hmm.
in the time of its release. So it's even more staggering, even though it has had re-releases, as you've said. But something like it sold as many tickets as there were people in the U.S. Some staggering figure that I read.
That is.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So there's plenty to discuss with this film, you know, we're not exactly expertly equipped to do so without the help of our guests this evening. And so let's get that started. And who better to begin with than one of our most respected and insightful film critics? Molly Haskell was the film critic for The Village Voice and New York Magazine and Vogue, and her writings have also graced the pages of The New York Times, Esquire, and The New York Observer, just to name a few. And her observations on the treatment of gender in film is unparalleled, as evidenced by her stunning books From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies, and Holding My Own in No Man's Land, Women and Men and Films and Feminists. You knew and you felt about this landmark film. Do you remember being particularly taken by the film when you were younger, and what about it appealed to you?
I do. I don't remember it. I sort of remember reading the book a little more vividly just because it came first and it was so momentous. You know, that, I mean, there was
mm-hmm.
something about it that was not only the excitement of Scarlett being so rebellious, and it was really the beginning of the whole country of teenagers. You know, we just didn't exist as a collective before that. So there was something, sort of a watershed about it, plus the fact that it was racy and in ways that we didn't quite grasp. Then the movie just took over. I mean, I don't remember exactly when I saw it, but from that point on, it was the movie that whose images stayed in my mind and sort of subsumed the book under it. And I just remember being so completely, it was one of those things where the movie is overwhelming on so many different levels, and the characters are so vivid, even though it was period. It didn't seem like period, and we argued about whether we like Rhett or Ashley better. I know that seems strange today because nobody really understands Leslie Howard's appeal now, or at least not in that film. But at the time, there was something absolutely irresistible about that sort of aloof Anglo aristocratic air that he had. So so we argued about that, and as if they were characters in our own lives, and even about Melanie and Scarlett, there were actually some people, though it's surprising they would even admit it, some girls who liked Melanie better than Scarlett. So they were just such vivid characters to us, and defining. I think we defined ourselves and our tastes against these characters, and of course, we didn't know enough to quite appreciate the glories of Technicolor and all that, but now looking back, it is something sort of wonderful, even about the too-muchness of the film, I think.
It's glorious,
yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I understand that you gained a different kind of appreciation for the film in the early 70s. I think it involved a panel with
Gloria
Steinem.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, it was the beginning of this. In fact, it's the very first time I remember ever talking about women's roles in movies, and then, of course, I wrote a book about it. But this was the first time it was actually a subject of debate and conversation. So on the panel were Gloria Steinem and myself, and she just immediately brought the example of Scarlett O'Hara as that of sort of female imprisonment and you know, the repression and the 17-inch waist and the sort of obligatory flirtations and all that, and I just leapt to her defense because I saw her in a completely different way, as sort of headstrong and willful and rebellious and refusing to be ladylike. So those were kind of the two poles of feminism, I guess, as they evolved, and both were legitimate and both were true in a way, but I always was sort of more interested in the kind of heroic side or the stronger, the women less as victim than as, if not triumphant, at least pushing the envelope.
Yes, and it's a fascinating character, and I know that you're obviously in the world of film criticism, you're the foremost authority on women in film and kind of gender roles in film. And Scarlett is such a complicated, at times contradictory character. And I'm wondering how much was that character of her time and ahead of her time?
Well, I think she's almost out of time in one way, because as you say, there is something so contradictory. I mean, she's so exasperating. You want to wring her neck one minute, and the next minute you want to forgive her and sort of embrace her.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, she's vile to her sisters and to other people, and she uses people, and she manipulates and lies and cheats and steals and all of that, and yet she's an absolute, you know, lioness when it comes to getting down in the dirt and protecting her, Tara, and sustaining this whole family and she becomes a businesswoman after the war, not a very upright one, but nevertheless discovers how much she loves to work even when she doesn't need to anymore. So she's sort of grasping and greedy, but also heroic and gallant. She's wonderful to Melanie, even though she doesn't want to be. When Melanie, I think the scene directed by Cooper, when Melanie delivers a baby and Scarlett gets her through that, is sort of magnificent. And I think one reason or one way that we accept her is that other people that we respect who have a kind of moral authority like her, like Rhett and Mammy and Melanie.
Right.
So I think she's out of time and yet timely in so many different eras, because she was a jazz, and Margaret Mitchell was writing this really in the 20s. It didn't come out until 36, but she had stopped writing in 1930. So it really wasn't about the Depression, although when it came out in the movie, people thought of it as the Depression fable. But she was really a jazz-age heroine. That's what Margaret Mitchell was. She was a sort of wild woman and a flapper and a party girl. And she sobered up later and became a sort of Melanie figure. But in her 20s, she was a bit of a wild woman. And Scarlett came out of that. The whole emphasis on youth and not wanting to get older and not wanting to marry. You have this in F. Scott Fitzgerald, these heroines that think marriage is a dirty word. And so that's something very ever-present. It's what is woman's role in the new order? And we've been asking our question that in different ways for the last, you know, seven decades.
Yeah. And what fascinates me about the book is that it's not only obviously an examination of gender and the complexities of these characters, but it's also a great movie lover's insider story on how this film came to be. And Margaret Mitchell, as you mentioned, there was a lot of her in Scarlet, and she was reticent at first to have a feature film treatment of her.
Oh, she didn't want it at all, because by this time she had decided that she just wanted to be sort of have her own quiet, conventional place as the good lady. I mean, she'd had a lot of accidents and illnesses, and she'd become sort of conservative and matronly, and she just wanted to fit in with Atlanta as opposed to this rebel and scandal monger she'd once been. So the idea of this, I mean, she trusted Selznick because he had done other adaptations faithfully. She felt he was the best man for the job, but at the same time, she felt it was too long and unwieldy, and it couldn't be done, and it would be a travesty in some way that would embarrass her. And, of course, there were things that did embarrass her. The whole portrait of Tara itself was what she saw as and had written about as a big farmhouse. And it became this grandiose mansion, and she knew things like that would happen. So she didn't want to have anything to do with the film, at least for all, you know, technical purposes. So she wouldn't go to Hollywood. She did have a correspondence with David Selznick. I mean, those two couldn't resist putting things down on paper, no matter what. So they were sort of made for each other that way, and she was sort of advising, kvetching from the sidelines. But she also had this Susan Myrick, somebody she'd recommended as an expert on Southern manners, to be on the set and sort of coaching and vetting things. And so
right.
Susan would report back to her. So she knew what was going on, and she was, I think, basically, she saw a movie when she wrote. I just can't believe she didn't think it would be made into a movie even when she was writing it. But at the same time, she wanted to preserve her deniability. You know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And it was, it's funny because it seemed Selznick was such a strong-willed person and was part of the appeal of this project for him, the fact that people said it couldn't be done, that it was too big?
Well, I think he was worried about that aspect of it, and he hadn't just jumped on board right away. He hadn't read the novel. It was Kay Brown who kept pushing him, and at that moment, Civil War movies were just not doing well at all. So Red the Rose had come out and tanked. Earlier in the silent era, there'd been a huge spate of them. Everybody loved them, but now they were suddenly out. So it was that, and it was so long, and the fact that he was such a faithful adapter, as he had been with Dickens and other Little Women and things like that, and especially with this one, because he knew everybody would have read the book, whereas when you get some 19th century novel, people have fairly vague literary memories. Here, they would be holding him to the fire on everything. So I think he was such a risk taker, though. I think he was a gambler, and he just decided, once he decided he wanted to do it, but he was both strong-willed and also nervous, and he was chaotic, and yet he was a perfectionist. He was all like Scarlett in her way. He was full of all these contradictory characteristics. You couldn't quite pin him down. He drove everybody crazy. And it is, I think, it is something that film buffs love to think about, because it goes against all the rules, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Michael makes a good argument about Fleming and maybe being responsible for Vivian Leigh's toughness, but I think it's really one of those miracles that it turned out the way it did, and I think, because it shouldn't have been, there were 5 directors and 15 screenwriters and hirings and firings. So I think there are a lot of people responsible for the fact that it did, and I think, for instance, William Cameron Menzies, the production designer, is one.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
The sort of the visual unity of the film, which is very important. The film is long and full of disparate kind of, you know, micro and macro visions as if.
Yeah, and you mentioned Mr. Fleming's direction of Vivian Leigh, and how did she come on board, and why was she? What
just,
in her was like Scarlett?
Well, it was the most improbable thing, and I was just reading Laurence Olivier's autobiography, and he said that it was just something outrageous that she should have taken it. Here she was a total unknown as far as Hollywood was concerned. She'd done a few films in England. Corda, she was signed on with Corda, and had impressed people with her beauty, but not much else. And she just took it into her head that she was going to do this. And she, once having read the book, she decided the part was going to be hers, and she paid her own way to America, to Hollywood. Olivier was over here getting ready to do Wuthering Heights, and his agent was Myron Selznick, David Selznick. Brother, so she engineered that she would meet Myron, and that Myron would, and he was then convinced that she would make a great Scarlet. So they'd already started shooting the movie. They were doing the burning of Atlanta. They had it was when the Technicolor cameras became available. That's when they had to do it. So it was
right.
in December of 1938, and it was this sort of grand spectacle that the invited guests had come to, and David Selznick was up on his platform, with his megaphone, and all that, and all of these. And so Myron shows up late with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh, and he introduces her to David Selznick and said, "Here's your Scarlett." And there was Vivian Leigh with her green eyes sort of dancing in the firelight, and that was it. I mean, she did the screen test, and she was signed up immediately.
Wow.
But it wasn't something where he had, because he loved discovering and, you know, actresses, and he knew he had to have somebody, and that was where he was very shrewd, I think, that had to be a newcomer, but somebody who could carry it. And that was, when you think about it, that's a pretty hard act to fill, because all the established actresses who would have had the experience had their own persona and images, and it would have been a Betty Davis film or a Katharine Hepburn film, unlikely as that casting seems to us now. She was in the running for it.
Sure.
Or an unknown who wouldn't have had the heft, and so it was just a very tricky role to cast, and it just turned out brilliantly, obviously.
A very daunting, iconic role, and I'm curious, where was Vivian Leigh in her own life, and how did her own personality kind of morph with Scott?
Well, yeah, she had, at that time, this was sort of early in her career, she wasn't young, but she was 21 or something, but she was madly in love with Olivia. This was right at the height of their affair, and they were both still married to other people, he to Jill Esmond and she to Leigh Holman, and they had just begun carrying on in pot, and they just couldn't keep their hands off each other, and it was a big scandal in England, and she had a child and he had a child, but somehow they didn't get punished for it as they might have if they'd been Hollywood stars. There was something about them that was just sort of patrician and English, and people let them off the hook. But she was madly in love with him, and this is one of the things. I think she was a very driven person anyway, and she put so much into the film, and part of it finally was there was something really intense and feverish in her personality. She would be later diagnosed as manic depressive. She started having crack-ups sort of about 7 or 8 years later, but the seeds were there already. Also, she would be diagnosed with tuberculosis. So some of this feverishness was mental and physical illness that was not yet diagnosed, and some of it was just her desperate desire to get back to Olivier. Selznick wouldn't give her enough time off until finally he wasn't satisfied with the beginning of the film where she entrances the Tarleton brothers on the veranda of Tara, and so they had to wait. They waited till the end to reshoot it, and by that time she just looked tired and bedraggled and too old. So he sent her off for 2 weeks of R&R with Olivier, and she came back after this marathon session looking dewy and virginal, and they shot the scene, and it was perfect. So that's what sex did for her.
She was all refreshed.
Yeah, all refreshed.
So how did the success of this film? It's a phenomenon. I think even now it's adjusted for inflation. It's still the biggest box office draw of all time.
Right.
How did it affect these three principal figures that we've been talking about?
Well, I think there was it was sort of the triumph and the trauma of their lives and careers. It was both a blessing and a curse. For Margaret Mitchell, the fame was just overwhelming, and first of all with the book, and then just triple and quadruple that with the movie. Nobody would leave her alone, and she was a very private person. And it was very disturbing to her. I mean, when they were casting the movie, all these women would come ringing her doorbell, asking her to put in a good word for them, and people want it constantly. I mean, unbelievably barraged by requests. And that was disturbing, and then she got sort of obsessed with the, she was very smart about copyright. Her brother and father were both intellectual copyright lawyers, and she started pursuing people that were contraband copies being published here and there, and that just became a mission for her. But she was a little crazed by it all, and she died young. She had a series of ailments, but she and her husband were going to a movie, and there was a cab careening around a corner, and she couldn't get out of the way, and it mowed her down, and she died a couple of days later. She was only 49. Selznick, although he had successes after that, nothing ever quite equaled it, and I think the trouble was he thought he could do anything after it. There were no limits, so his grandiosity was it was almost too much. And finally, he was in litigation. Also, he had to make such a sort of unfortunate deal with MGM, with L.B. Mayer, his father-in-law, that he had to pay over so much that he finally had to give up Selznick International Pictures, and he didn't make anything like as much money as he should have, and he was in constant litigation, and he was in a lawsuit about that when he died at, I think, 63. And Vivian Leigh was beset by this manic depression, got worse and worse, and Olivier divorced, and she was with Jack Merivale, an actor who really took care of her in her final. I mean, she wasn't ill or an invalid or anything, but she just had a series of sort of manic episodes and depression, and she had a lot of electroshock therapy.
Wow.
And the TB, and I think it was the TB that finally did her in. So she died. And I think the film, she worked something like 125 days to Clark Gable's like 53. So she just worked so much longer and harder than anybody else. She put so much of herself into it. I think it used her up in some way. So I think they were all burnt out by it, but I don't think they would have, maybe, I don't know, would they have traded it in for a longer, more serene lives? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You talk
about Clark Gable. Just to ask a question about Rhett Butler. As Scarlett kind of challenged gender roles and classifications at that time, was Rhett Butler the same way for the male counterpart?
Well, I don't know. What was interesting about Rhett Butler is, and what Clark Gable brought to it were two things. One was the virility, because if you look at it on paper, and I think this is one of the improvements of the film anyway, but even before you get to Clark Gable, is that he's very long-winded in the book, and he's very full of wisdom about everything. And it's so much a woman's, I mean, she, we've just said, Vivian Leigh worked 125 days. Well, that's just so much the dominant role is hers. And not only that, the film itself is a matriarchy. Mammy and Scarlett and Melanie are all so strong, and in the book there are a lot of other strong women, whereas the men are really pretty weak, except for Rhett Butler, and even he is fairly passive on paper. And yet Clark Gable brings this virility to it so that it seems like an equal match, and that's an amazing thing, so that it transcends the sort of the restrictions of the woman film, and it does that also by casting such a large canvas, such a large historical point of view.
Yeah.
And I think, but the other thing that Gable brings, and I think this is helped by his trust in Victor Fleming, is that he shows a sort of gentler side of himself than a more complex side of himself. He didn't want to do the role. He wasn't comfortable. He really preferred just playing these sort of charming rogues that were just so easy for him, and the women fell all over themselves to get to him. And he said he complained before he did this. He said, in every other film, a woman just takes one look at me and she knows she wants to go to bed with me, and here she doesn't. So here he's got this heroine who's just resisting and resisting him. And aside from the fact that the role was so well known that it was a danger, if he misfired, it was a career catastrophe, as it would have been for Selznick too. I mean, they were all taking a big risk, but this is what they had to do, and they did it.
Talking about taking a big risk, this film has a rabid fan base, and they're pretty protective of Gone with the Wind. I'm curious what your conversations with these fans have been like in their reaction to your book.
Well, so far, it's very strange. In the very beginning, I had a lot of sort of radio talks and one thing and another with fans. I haven't heard from them recently. On call-in radio shows, what surprised me is the intensity of responses for and against. One man was a northerner who spent 6 years in the South, and he just was fed up with the South, the fact that it still called it the war between the states and blamed Lincoln, and felt that the South should secede, and he felt that Margaret Mitchell and the movie were perpetuating the myth of the noble South, which in a sense they are. And then other people, from Black's interesting pro and con, and then somebody else called in from this old man from South Carolina complaining about Sherman burning the church down. It's like the war is not over yet in some places.
Right.
I'm not sure about the rabid fan base. I think if people who are just pure fans probably don't want any, even though there's nothing particularly negative about my book, it's still critical in the sense of it's not just pure gush.
Mm.
But it's, I don't know. So if maybe people, I don't know. You'll have to tell me. I just don't know.
No, I think it's beautiful how your book is your affection for the film is evident, but it is clearly a reassessment of a lot of what the film represents, and isn't that the marking of a great movie 70 years later?
I think
you're
so.
Still finding,
I think it
more.
Has, yeah, I think the fact that that you take something that's so taken for granted and then just don't take it for granted, just step back and say, well, let's look at it in this day and age. Can we talk about it differently than we did in the set? I think one reason I probably never would have tackled it if Yale University Press hadn't asked me to do it as part of their American Icon series is it just is so hot to handle in so many ways still. The race issue is still difficult to talk. You know, I think in the 70s it was just almost impossible. We were just so sensitive to the portraits of Blacks as menials and servants that and not enough progress had been made that we could sort of see the larger picture. But I think some good writing has come out from scholars of Black cinema that take a more nuanced view. I think that now is really a good time it's become a good time, and of course, thanks to Obama's presidency, to talk about the racial aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
The feminist aspects, too, have been problematic for some people. So there's a lot that keeps the argument at the boil. On the other hand, I'm not sure. The one thing I'm curious about is whether young people or youngish people, I mean, not just teenagers, but people in their 30s and 40s are interested in it. I'm sure some are. I mean, it always attracts some people. Some people just discover it and love it. But I don't think it has the cross-the-board generational appeal that maybe it did for my generation. I don't know. That's something I'm curious about.
Yeah, it is curious. I mean, I'm prejudiced. I'm a movie geek, so
I
read
it.
Everything I can. So.
Yeah, but that's the people I think that most respond to my book, and I probably will. And so far, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not really sure, but that's what I think. Because it's just, I think I love books anyway that sort of reassess. I think what critics love to do, most of them, of course, Pauline Kael was the great exception to that, is see movies again.
Right,
because we change and they do, and it's just so much fun to reevaluate them. I think. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I love the book, and I love your writing, and I'm so honored that you're part of our show, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to hearing it.
Thank you.
Okay, Jamie. Bye bye.
Okay, that was Molly Haskell. The book is called Gone. The book is actually called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. You can purchase it here on our homepage. Click that front cover icon of the book, and it'll take you directly to Amazon.com, the page where you can purchase it. And you can do it right now, and you can still listen to the show. It'll open up in a brand new window. It's great stuff.
It is. That was a good interview. I want to touch on some stuff that
sure, please, please.
You know, she brings up a good point, not just about the movie, but about a lot of movies. And this is something I've been thinking about lately because, you know, we are getting older and going through different generational shifts and just, you know, we see things differently. And it's amazing when you do go back to a film like Gone with the Wind every couple of years, you do think of that. That's a good film to use that you think about differently because I think you can relate to some of the character struggles. I think a lot of people, Scarlett's character is very important. Because everyone, in some way, has been affected by the economy the last year or so. And there are scenes in that film that no one can ever forget. Like she says, I will never go hungry again, where she makes the dress out of her curtains. I mean, these are really iconic scenes and that played out very powerfully. And then Gone with the Wind was, of course, released at the towards the end of the Depression, of course, and the war was starting. Was going to start in another, well, start in Europe, but started 2 years later. But these are things that people identified with very strongly.
I think so. And another very unique thing about the film, too, not the least of which is the time it was made.
Right.
It is the fact that it deals with a woman in wartime as
mm-hmm.
well.
Yeah, I mean, totally. Like Mrs. Miniver, I guess the British equivalent would be Mrs. Miniver. But they're both, and that's another thing she brings up. It is a women's movie because while the Civil War is going on, it's Melanie, Scarlett, Mammy. They're the ones who are in charge.
Yeah.
There's not a man in sight. Everyone's at war. And that whole middle part of the film is very important. And Scarlett is really just this fiercely, you know, the war turns her into this fiercely independent woman.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about that throughout the next interview, too, mm-hmm. I believe. The contradictory nature of Scarlett as a character. The kind of two sides of her fighting, and that's replicated in, you know, her desire for these two men as well. It is a fascinating, challenging character, and one that Molly has grown to understand more and more as the years
right.
have passed. It takes on different meaning throughout the different decades.
Yeah.
Which is how we expressed it in the interview, the sign of a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a film that grows in your consciousness after a period of 70 years. I mean, it's amazing how this film is still alive. You've actually seen it as a theatrical presentation.
I saw it twice in 1 week, actually. I went with my mom one night, and then I went with my brother the next night. This is, I guess, in 1989. And I thought I'd seen it so many times on TV, you know, growing up. You know, I liked it, but after the first time watching on a big screen, and that's just true with Lawrence a couple months later, you really appreciate these films.
Mm-hmm.
When you see them on the beat, because that's how they are really meant to be seen, and especially Gone with the Wind really meant to be seen on a big screen.
You know, there's something else that I always think about when I think of films of that era, and we touched upon it. I think in the next interview
mm-hmm.
too. That golden age of Hollywood,
yes,
where you seem to have these gigantic personalities.
Mm-hmm.
Selznick, Gable,
mm-hmm.
Olivier, Vivian Leigh, on and on and on. I'm wondering, 70 years from now, will people look back at our era where we are now and feel the same way? And why wouldn't they?
I don't know. It's really interesting that you bring it up, because I've often thought, where will some of these movies, like, let's take the movie we're going to be talking about next week, Heat. How will that stack up in 70 years? Will people still think the same, you know, of that film? I mean, I hope they're still talking about films 70 years from now.
I hope so, too. But I'm wondering what might have altered that. Because I think that kind of recognition stopped around the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it's gone. Is it the gossip mongering culture? They had gossip trades back then, in the Gone with the Wind time. I mean, there wasn't the intense scrutiny that there is today, where you follow their every move. Maybe that's why. I'm not sure.
That's part of it. I also just think we live in. I think there was just the culture. Like, that's part of it. The tabloid culture. We live in such a where everything evaporates. The news cycle is like at best 24 hours. And it's like the news cycle. We seem to, sadly, I think it has something to do with the opening weekend. By Friday night, we know whether a movie, at least to the studios, is going to be a hit or not.
Right.
It's like almost, and I think that has something to do with it. I also think the sad thing is that, unfortunately, success is really measured, as it always has been to an extent, in box office. And I think if it doesn't, if the movie bombs and if people don't talk about it, it does get a life. People do discover it. I think some movies that are good, actually, that don't play, you know, long, and they do get a life and they have a cult following. But I think you've touched on something that's very important to the times we live in. It's just everything seems to just come and go so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at someone like a D.W. Griffith, the Times, a Selznick, these were grandiose visionaries. These were you know, the kind of like the P.T. Barnums in cinema.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted to put on the
analogy.
Yeah, they wanted to put on the greatest show on earth.
Yeah.
Who was the equivalent today? Michael Bay. I mean, it's the times are they've changed a bit, and so when you look at those classic stars and films, they have this kind of sheen on them that
mm-hmm.
that it makes me very wistful for a time I didn't even exist in.
Well, that's kind of the point I was getting at with Coppola. And I don't mean to like interchange the two topics, but
no, fine, that's fine.
But the thing I was going with when I asked him about the whether you shoot on the, do you want to basically shoot on the computer or do you want to shoot on location? The thing I was trying to really get at is it goes with not only Coppola but like directors like John Huston, John Milius, these larger than life guys, David Lean. And that's the only director I can think of that right now who is so insane like that is Werner Herzog.
Mm-hmm.
That has like, this personality that, as we know, just shows up
mm-hmm.
on the set. Even when he doesn't need Klaus Kinski for that to come out, it comes out.
Right.
But it seems like the only person I can think of someone brought up is maybe James Cameron.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly.
Possibly, but I'm not. I don't know if there's anyone. I think the sad thing is you might be right when you jokingly say Michael Bay. I think you may have hit on the equivalence of what they think. And that's a mixed blessing right there, because that personality is there. I have friends of mine who have worked for him, and he is quite a presence on the set.
I am just talking about in terms of, I'm not talking about in quality of film.
No,
because
no,
I'm, obviously
personality.
I'm talking about personality, force of personality. And obviously there are some very strong people that make films, strong personalities
out
there. But I'm envious of you seeing it in a theater because I've never had that experience. Because just that Technicolor experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Glorious Technicolor. It's such a gorgeous film. I mean, one of the most gorgeously photographed films.
Mm-hmm.
The score.
That's
Diner,
baby, yeah.
Yeah, I've known of people that fell in love with movie scores starting with the moment that they heard Steiner's work in that film. And obviously, as Ms. Haskell expressed, the production design. And
mm-hmm.
Just an enormous undertaking and just indelible performances. And complicated performances, and a real emotional connection that stays 70 years later. Let's get to the next interview.
Okay.
And I feel terrible. This is one of the best writers of film that we have, and I mispronounced his name at the very beginning. That's terrible me. But this is an exciting segment. We were considering speaking about Gable or speaking about Vivian Leigh, and we have with these two guests on tonight's show, but we also wanted to pay particular attention to someone that's not brought up very often, and he should be, because he directed two of the defining films of the 20th century with Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. And so the big question is, why isn't his name a part of the popular vernacular? And critic Michael Schrago sets out to rectify this oversight with his new book, Victor Fleming, An American Movie Master, which you can purchase right next to Molly's book here on our homepage. Mr. Schrago has been a film critic and columnist for the New York Times, The New Yorker, where he actually worked with Pauline Kael, and The Atlantic and Salon.com, and he also currently writes for the Baltimore Sun. And we had the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Schrago about his wonderful book, and Mr. Fleming's indelible imprint in the history of cinema. Let's talk about Victor Fleming.
Sure.
When did your consciousness of him begin?
Well, I've known Victor Fleming, you know, for decades. I mean, it's funny. The first Victor Fleming movie I saw was Captain's Courageous when I was about six, and then.
Oh, that's a wonderful film.
It's a great
wonderful.
Film.
Yeah.
It's actually the first time I saw a film that made me want to read the book, except I was in first grade and the book was in the fifth grade library. And my mother actually had to accompany me to school to prove to the fifth grade teacher that I could borrow a book from her library so I could read enough of the words. And then, of course, I read the book and realized it was nothing like the film.
Isn't that a bummer when it happens?
Well, actually, it wasn't, because actually the book is equally good in its own way. It just shows you how, you know, over the years people's memories blur, especially if they see the movie at a young age and then read the book, or read the book at a young age and then see the movie. It's one of those rare occasions, Captain's Courageous is, where the movie takes vast liberties, yet somehow retains a lot of the spirit, and certainly achieves something of as great quality as Kipling did in the novel. So the memory seems to think, oh, they're the same thing, when they're vastly different. Of course, that's opposite of what happens with Gone with the Wind, which is really, you know, tries to be trenchantly faithful to the book, you know, with provided for the compression they needed to do to get it into even, you know, 4-hour running time. So those are actually two very different aspects of Fleming's talent. So actually, yes, so Fleming, at the time when I was age 6, I didn't realize that that was a Victor Fleming movie. But as time went by and I became a movie critic very early on, I loved movies from a kid. From being a kid, and you know, when I was growing up in the 50s and early 60s, you know, the great breakthrough on TV was having Saturday Night at the Movies or Sunday Night at the Movies, these primetime network airings of films that would be in 2-hour slots, so they would be less cut than what you were used to seeing on the early show or the late show, or all these syndicated packages of great old movies. But because of those syndicated packages, you did see a lot of great old movies, and I did see you know, Treasure Island, another, you know, terrific Victor Fleming film, and I probably did see Test Pilot at that point, although I really only retained it seeing it as an adult. So when I later thought about The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind in those films, I realized that Victor Fleming had really, for entire generations of moviegoers, made the movies that most people thought of when they thought about movies. You know, he was really kind of the father of an American movie-making tradition, and yet had been totally neglected for many reasons. I got to tell you guys, because you'll appreciate this, the one question that I get asked invariably by people who either talk to me on shows like this or want to talk to me on shows like this is when I lay out that, you know, he directed all these great films, that he and created stars while doing so, that he directed Gary Cooper and what Cooper said was his favorite film, The Virginian, you know, which was a, you know, completely milestone Western, the Western where you first hear lines like, if you want to call me that smile. You know, it's you know, amazing movie, as influential as Stagecoach, that he made that he made Bombshell and Red Dust, Gene Harlow's two best movies, that he made the classic version of Treasure Island, that he made, you know, Captain's Courageous, that he made Test Pilot, that he made Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, that he made Henry Fonda's first film, The Farmer Takes a Wife, which in many ways is a really charming film, and Fonda credited him with creating Henry Fonda on movies, and that he molded Spencer Tracy, and got many of Tracy's best performances, not just in Captain's Courageous, but in particularly Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a highly underrated version of that. That he was Ingrid Bergman's favorite director and got her sexiest performance, co-starring with Tracy and Jekyll and Hyde. I lay out all these things, and people say, well, why haven't I heard of him? I like to say, well, that's why I wrote the book. But I think there, you know, it's just so funny to me. I mean, that's exactly the purpose for the book. But I think there are a lot of reasons. I think, for one thing, he died young. He died younger than people thought. People misreported even his age at his death. He was 59, and he died in 1949. And that was, and not only did he die young, but he died before filmmakers were routinely treated as if they were cultural heroes. So he didn't get that big blast of publicity that you know, others of his generation got, who lasted longer. Also, he was not a self-promoter. So even in his time, there were directors who occasionally got a big national promotion. Frank Capra was on the cover of Time in 1938, whereas the MGM publicist couldn't get Victor on the cover in a major magazine, even the year he was directing The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, in the same year. So,
yeah, that's incredible that you couldn't do that. Wow.
Yeah, and he, as Todd McCarthy said in an article in Variety in 1995, where he predicted there'd never be a biography of Victor Fleming for this reason, a lot of times, you know, directors' reputations rest on how many good interviews they give later in their careers.
Right.
Of course,
right.
Fleming never got that stage, and he was, and though he retained good relationships with a lot of Hollywood columnists, and gave a lot of material that I could mine for the book, he never gave a long career interview or was the type to look over and overthink what he did in his career. He was much more instinctive, as well as craftsman-like filmmaker. And also he was so versatile that you couldn't look back and say, oh, well, like Hitchcock, he created the modern thriller, or, you know, or even like John Ford, who did many things, but we still associate himself with the Western. Victor Fleming did, you know, a great Western, The Virginian. He did probably the prototype screwball comedy in Bombshell. He did the most, you know, the sexiest pre-production code erotic drama in Red Dust. You know, he did films that played wonderfully with families, like Treasure Island, Captain's Courageous. He did one of the greatest buddy pictures in Test Pilot, fantasy in Wizard of Oz, historical drama in Gone with the Wind. I mean, he really did everything, and often did it better than anyone had before. I think there was another problem, in that over half his films were lost. He was a great silent film director. So a lot of people, until recently, you couldn't see really good prints of the great comedies he did with Douglas Fairbanks, When the Clouds Roll By and Mollycoddle, which you can now see thanks to a Flickr Alley box that just got put out last December. I had to see these things to get good prints. I had to see them in museums. His movies with Clara Bow are still not readily available, but Mantrap, the movie he made with Clara Bow, was not just one of her best movies. It was really her commercial breakthrough and critical breakthrough, and it was a year before she made It. He really made her the It girl before she made It. So you know, there were all these things, and that's another reason you didn't know about him, because you know a lot of his legacy was just not that readily available to be seen. So all these reasons conspired to make him a forgotten man when he really should have been one of the most celebrated men in Hollywood history.
Absolutely. And everything that you just expressed just inspires countless questions. It's great that you did this book for all of those reasons.
Just
to bring him...
Todd McCarthy wrong. I mean, that was great right there.
Well, like I said, Todd was great. I mean, Todd was a great help when he knew I was doing the book. He gave me all the leads that he had assembled for his Howard Hawks biography, which was really nice because... I mean, in the course of Todd's very honest Howard Hawks book, you realize that Hawks was a great director, but just a terrible liar, and was one of those people, and even though he was one of Vic's best directing friends, the other was King Vidor, both Hawks and Vidor sort of seemed to be working off some kind of bitterness or jealousy about Fleming after he died in the stories they told. He was always sort of the butt of their stories, and they both liked to take credits, more credit than they were owed for work they did or didn't do on his films. So that was another thing going against him. He had a bad choice in Friends in terms of his legacy.
But you see Fleming's influence, especially with Gone with the Wind, in so many recent films. So something like Baz Luhrmann's Australia,
God.
And also in places you wouldn't expect, you see. I bring this up a couple times, the Steven Spielberg version of War of the Worlds. There are several scenes where Tom Cruise is looking at the horizon. It's just like when Vivian Leigh looks to the sky after certain scenes on Terra. Mm-hmm. And it's straight from that. And you see, I think the film is incredible because you just see the influence every couple of months in a film. You see it.
Yeah.
Well,
of course, Spielberg is probably the most prominent and vocal of Fleming's admirers and has been for decades. And, of course, remade one of Fleming's biggest hits, A Guy Named Joe, as always. So he's always very conscious of Fleming as an influence. I mean, the interesting thing about the visual style of Gone with the Wind is that it's different for Fleming. And of course, I say in the book, I grant that Selznick's use of William Cameron Menzies for the production design and the many storyboards they did had an influence. But it was really up to Fleming to make sure that those storyboards weren't just scenic, that they had real dramatic impact, that the performers really registered in them, both because of their performances and how they were placed within the screen. And he was the guy on the boom when they did the famous crane shot of the rebel dead and dying in the train yard.
Right.
And of course, what makes that is not just the expanse of the heartrending expanse of the remnants of the Confederacy, but the dramatic focus is still Scarlett as she makes her way from one corner of the screen to the other. That's what Fleming never forgot in his directing, is where the emotional focus of a scene was, and that seemed so simple, and yet that's the thing that especially a lot of younger directors seem to forget as soon as they get a camera in their hand that they can whip around.
Well, first let me ask you this. What's fascinating to me about Fleming is these two enormous films with Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get more legendary than these two.
No.
He wasn't the first choice of director for either one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny with The Wizard of Oz, it's an odd case where that had been championed as a property both by Arthur Freed, who became he really got his cut his teeth producing on that film, even though he doesn't get a credit, but he was a uncredited associate producer, and Mervyn Leroy, the producer who had just come over from Warner Brothers to be a major producer for MGM, and both of them really championed that as a property. But the first director they chose, and I don't know why, was Richard Thorpe. He was a journeyman director, and he had a few good credits to his name. I mean, before Gone with the Wind, he did Tarzan Escapes, which was a really good Tarzan movie. And,
it is, yeah.
And in the early 50s, he did Ivanhoe, which is a great swashbuckler.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just not the right guy for this movie. And Leroy even said that he thought he was so in love with Toto that that's what threw him off. The footage was like too Toto-centric. And then, of course, George Cukor,
yeah.
A great director in his own right, came on. And he, of course, when the irony of this is he was preparing to do Gone with the Wind, which they had been preparing for years with producer David S. Selznick. And he came on just in time to fix some of the makeup and the costume design. And he made some very good choices, including returning Judy Garland to a more natural look. They had actually kind of glammed her up a bit. But when Fleming came on, and Fleming, once those two bad or unworkable decisions were made, and they really needed a director, Fleming was really one of the first choices of Freed and Leroy. They both thought he was a great director, and Freed often said not just was he a great director, but he was the right director for that movie because he knew just from talking of him, he had a kind of poetic sense of childhood that they could really use for Wizard of Oz. And once Fleming came on, he absolutely acted like the top director on that movie from beginning to end. He did what he did with all his productions. He called in his favorite screenwriter, John Lee Mayen, who Scott Fitzgerald called one of the half dozen guys in Hollywood who knew how to make movies. They revamped the screenplay from beginning to end. They gave a counterpart in Kansas to the Cowardly Lion. They, instead of Judy just strolling down the country trails at the beginning of the original script that they started with, they gave it a much more tense vision of her scrambling to save Toto from the evil old hag played by Margaret Hamilton, and and even in terms of the costume choices for the opening. Vic, who had grown up on in hardscrabble circumstances on orange ranches in Southern California, he took one look at what Auntie Anne was wearing and told the costume department to rip off that apron and go to Woolworths and get the cheapest one they could find, because that's what someone would wear in those circumstances. So he really, even before he started to shoot, designed that whole movie from beginning to end. And that's what's so ironic, that when he was pulled off to do Gone with the Wind and King of Uterus came in just to do the Kansas scenes, which Fleming had already laid out and reworked with John Lee Mayen. The legend that Vitor had done so much more just sort of grew the more Fleming faded into the background through no fault of his own, and the more interviews Vitor gave later in life. So, again, it's just one of these sad things. I mean, and Fleming absolutely shot everything that you see in the film from the moment Judy opens the door and says, "Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore," to the moment she says, "There's no place like home." I mean, that is Victor Fleming, down to the yellow brick road.
Wow.
The yellow brick road was shaped with ovals before Fleming came on and took one look at it and said, "This is no road. We've got to get those yellow bricks in there. We've got to put a curb in there." He had been a race car driver and a mechanic and a chauffeur. He knew about roads. And then he even told the songwriting team, the incredible songwriting team of Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, "We need a real send-off for Dorothy when she leaves Munchkinland," and that's how Follow the Yellow Brick Road came into being. So he is absolutely the author of The Wizard of Oz. With Gone with the Wind, it's more complicated, of course. Selznick, and I think there's no reason not to trust Selznick, always gave him credit for shooting 60% of the movie. And I think not just Gable's performance, but also I think the relationship between Gable and Vivian Leigh, which to me is the real driving force of the movie and makes it seem so contemporary even today,
of course,
is really Fleming's.
Well, and I'm curious, obviously Gable loved him, Gable had a comfort level with Victor Fleming.
Right.
I think that was the main reason why he even agreed to do the film, because of his confidence in, in Fleming.
Well, I mean, that's the reason Fleming agreed to do the film after they fired George Cukor.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to help his friend Gable, and he knew, he probably also knew it was a great role for Gable. I mean, he didn't, he actually hadn't read the book when he first signed on to do the film, but he read the book shortly after, and he had a well-thumbed copy of it. He had a well-thumbed copy of it in his library, and his screenwriter Mann said he would always refer to, you know, chapter and verse in the book when he was referring to things. But I think he knew that the character Rhett Butler was something Gable could sink his teeth into if Gable were comfortable with the director. But on the other hand, I do think the reason they fired Cukor had nothing to do with Gable. I think the producer Selznick just saw that Cukor wasn't giving him the footage he wanted. It just wasn't. Didn't have the snap he wanted. Didn't have the scale he wanted. And that was a problem that Cukor had with other big productions.
Right.
So it just, once that happened, I do think Selznick had admired Fleming for a long time. He knew that Gable and Fleming were good friends, and that Fleming was Gable's favorite director. So then I thought, yeah, then it was obviously they had to get Fleming to save Gone with the Wind.
But what was his approach with Gable and Vivian Leigh? These are two incredibly strong characters in real life and in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Was the approach different? How did he direct those actors?
Well, I mean, I think with Gable, who was very insecure by the time Fleming came along. He actually started the movie later than the two main actors that had Vivian Leigh and Olivia de Havilland. He didn't have any rapport with George Cukor. So by the time Fleming came along, he was a little out of sorts. I think Fleming both relaxed him and kind of vitalized him. He both used a lot of humor to set him at ease and also challenged him. And Vic had been a director of great male stars from the beginning of his career. His first two directing movies were with Douglas Fairbanks Sr., who was called the King of Hollywood, 20 years before Clark Gable became the King of Hollywood. And I think he used some of the same tricks. For example, the great scene everyone remembers, they call it the marital rape scene sometimes, of Gable sweeping Leigh up in his arms and going up the staircase. There's a famous story about technical snafus wrecking that scene for about 4 or 5 takes, and finally Gable's on his 6th take going up that long set of stairs, and he hears the whole crew breaking out laughing, and he turns around and wonders what's going on, and Fleming said, "Oh, don't worry, we got it last time. I just had a bet going you couldn't make it again." So, it was that kind of thing that sort of took some of the pressure off. It took some of the pressure even off of that incredible macho image that Gable had, and I think that also relates to Fleming being able to get Gable to do things that Gable wouldn't do with other directors. I mean, the crying scene is famous because of Gable's reluctance to cry tears over his fear that he caused Scarlett's miscarriage. And what I think is funny about that is that if you watch Test Pilot, which was made a year and a half earlier with Gable, Gable apparently had no problem crying for Fleming in Test Pilot over Spencer Tracy's body. So it is true that he was reluctant to cry over this this other family tragedy. But I think no one remarks on this, but I think maybe part of the reason he ultimately trusted Fleming was he knew how great that scene worked in Test Pilot. A lot of people thought, including the MGM publicity chief Howard Strickling and John Lee Mahon, the screenwriter, a lot of them thought that was Gable's best acting ever, was the final the climactic scene in Test Pilot when Tracy crashes and dies and Gable cries over him. And Fleming did things like offer to shoot the piece two ways in Gone with the Wind, one with Gable crying and one without, and show it to him. But it was pretty clear from even the reaction on the set that the shot with Gable crying was so much better that Gable was a real professional and would know what was best for the movie and best for his character. And that was the difference between Gable and Fleming, though. and a lot of actors who were around them said it was that Gable in some ways patterned himself on Fleming. A lot of people called him the real Rhett Butler, which was I called the introduction to my book the real Rhett Butler for that reason. But they all said the difference was that Fleming was unashamedly emotional. He wasn't afraid to show tears. He thought he knew a scene was good when he did cry on the set or saw other people crying on the set. So even though he was an incredible daredevil, traditionally masculine guy with a record of romantic conquests longer than anyone else's in Hollywood, and then a real attempt to be a devoted family man the way Rhett tries to be a devoted family man with his wife Lou before Ingrid Bergman just took the wind out of that sail. He was able to show emotion, and that's also what distinguishes his movies from those of the equally great director Howard Hawks. Hawks is always very controlled. Vic's movies really bubble over with this passion, and it comes straight from the heart of that man.
Yeah, and did that translate into his work with Vivien Leigh as well?
Well, with Vivien Leigh, I think it was a different case. I mean, Vivien Leigh came armed to the set. You know, she knew her part inside out. She had studied it with Cukor and continued to study it with Cukor on weekends. But I think the real spark of that performance comes from her coming up against Fleming. I actually think Leigh and Fleming are very much like Scarlett and Rhett, except without the love. I think the challenge was always
right
there, and Fleming knew that. He always said that he thought a great love scene was really a fight scene, and he often meant that very literally. But here he does it with such understanding of the mixed emotions that that these two people have, that it never seems inflated or trumped up in everything. It really is, unlike any other relationship in a movie that scale that you can think of.
Yeah, and what did the success of this film do for him? Even though he didn't live much longer after the, maybe a decade he lived after this film opened.
Yeah, like I said, he died in 49. Then this premiered in December 15th, 1939. He died early in 49. He had a huge reputation before. I think that's what people don't understand today, is that the whole reason he was so sought after for Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind was that his reputation was astronomical in Hollywood in 1938. Not only had he done earlier in the decade those Harlow movies, which were huge hits and loved in Hollywood just for being great entertainment, Captain's Courageous and Test Pilot back-to-back were both critical and popular sensations. They were among the biggest MGM moneymakers of their time. Treasure Island kept coming back and back and being revived. I mean, Graham Greene reviewed it in London at a revival and compared it favorably to a movie that his friend Carol Reed made, Midshipman Easy. I mean, he was just, as an artist and entertainer, he was at the top. His personal reputation was immense. I mean, the guys who would admire him for being what they thought was a lady killer, even though I actually think he more gave into his many romances than initiated them, they would try to get something out of him. Ben Heck said the only time he heard gentlemen's words at a table at MGM were when the directors tried to list the many women they slept with, and when they finally asked Fleming if how many women he'd loved, and he said just one, and they said all anxious, who? And he said, I married her. it was the one time they ever heard gentlemen's words at the table. So personally and professionally, his reputation actually couldn't have been bigger than it was before these movies. Afterwards, it was huge. It was because he did win his only Oscar for Gone with the Wind. But I don't think, to tell you the truth, I don't think it really mattered in Hollywood at that time. He had already negotiated a contract with MGM, which said that no producer could have a title on his film unless Fleming agreed to let him have it. That was before Gone with the Wind that he negotiated that contract. He was, sought after by the best stars, the best producers. I honestly don't think, I think in some ways it's very odd, until this year when he seems to be rediscovered, I hope with the help of my book. You could argue that Gone with the Wind had more to do with hurting his reputation than helping it, because he was so put in the shadow of the film's overall success, and Selznick became so much the dominant person, creative personality in terms of people trying to figure out who did what in the movie. Partly because Vic left no paper trail, and Selznick, of course, was known for his paper trail, just hundreds and hundreds of memos on every possible thing. So in an odd way, you could argue that even though funding was key to the success of Gone with the Wind, that its success actually helped diminish him and diminish his reputation, at least until now.
Right, right. It's such a fantastic book, and it's actually our listeners can purchase the book by clicking on the book cover icon on our homepage as they listen to the show. And just to close off, tell me about the journey of actually writing this book. Obviously, he's been passed away for the past 60 years, and there's not a wealth of material out there that's been readily available to movie fans previously. So what was
No, it was an adventure, and it absolutely was an adventure. And it started, over 10 years ago. I wrote a piece for the New York Times in 1998 about. I guess that would have been the 60th anniversary reissue of Wizard of Oz for that Christmas season.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter, Vic's younger daughter, got in touch with me and, has really felt all these years that no one had given her dad, or as he called him, daddy credit for everything that he'd done. And she really encouraged me to do that. Unfortunately, she didn't have very many papers or memorabilia or anything to show me. She shared everything she had. But she was very important because she persuaded MGM to open up their legal files to me. And even though they said, oh, there's nothing that important here, to me it was like a treasure trove because you saw things like things that people had used against Vic, like in the previous book on the making of The Wizard of Oz. A very good book in some ways by Al Jean Harmetz, but she really didn't like Vic, and she would say, well, everyone knew he wouldn't let a producer have a credit in his contract, but then he always would because he didn't really care, and that's not the case. I mean, there was this wonderful correspondence where someone from the business office thanks him for letting a producer have a credit on Tortilla Flat, and thanks Fleming for his kindness, and Fleming writes back saying, well, there's nothing kind about it. You promised me 3 months more vacation. He was really very hard-nosed about everything and really smart about how to play against the executives and really knowledgeable about how much power he had. So there was that. That was very useful, opening up the MGM legal files. But then it was really, especially the first 3 years, was a case of trying to get anyone who was still standing and articulate, who had any firsthand knowledge of Fleming to talk to me. And a lot of times there were things. I had a great interview with one of John Lee Mahon's sons, Graham Lee Mahon, and some of the things seemed so outlandish. It wasn't only then until 8 years later I could see that all the stuff he gave me 10 years ago really did fit into this larger-than-life man, Vic. I mean, he would talk about how just strange, funny things always happened around Vic, like once he went to this kind of saloon brothel with John Lee Mahon, and there was a different bartender behind the counter than the one they'd seen before, and the new bartender was saying, oh, well, that guy shot himself, and Vic said, well, how do you do that? And the bartender, picked up the gun and, in demonstrating it, shot himself. And,
God.
He ran out of, but his life was full of it. But, it could actually fit a lot of these stories that seemed too colorful or too weird in. And it was something that sort of he brought out in life, partly because he had an appetite for that kind of thing. That was part of what was fun about early Hollywood, was that there were
mm-hmm.
these characters
mm-hmm.
Who just loved the adventure of life. And at a time when America was discovering, not just movies, but cars and planes and the wide world and exploring, Vic did all of that, and I think all of it informed his movies.
Yeah. Oh, what a wonderful period of Hollywood history.
And I
treasure this book, and I commend you so much for bringing it out. And come back anytime. This has been delightful.
Really,
come back and talk movies with us anytime.
Oh, no, but please, you try me again. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. I really appreciate the attention you'll bring to Fleming and to the book. I really do.
Okay, that is Michael Schrago, and the book is Victor Fleming, an American Movie Master. You can purchase it on our homepage right here. Great conversation, great guest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, are you ready to close out with some trivia?
Sure.
What are you, Paul Newman in Hudsucker?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. My tribute. Speaking of Paul Newman, Sean Levy's new biography on Paul Newman is very good. I read it last week. It's a very good book.
Yeah, we got to get him on. Why hasn't he come on?
Yeah, I know. He's welcome anytime he wants to come on. We've talked about it, so hopefully soon.
Okay, the American Film Institute, obviously they come out with, they started coming out with lists, and they have a new one every year, I think,
mm-hmm.
around the holiday season. 2007, they ranked Gone with the Wind as the number 6 greatest movie of all time.
Mm.
And they also ranked, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, as the number 1 movie quote of all time.
Wow, okay.
Yes. So many quotable lines from the film that have just survived the test of time. Gone with the Wind was the first color film to win Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
It cost $3.9 million, for those of you that care.
Yeah, and it's amazing. At that time, that was so much money, and that's not, that doesn't even cover really like one of those boutique independent films, you know, that come out these days. So, wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
There are about 2,400 extras on the film, which was another thing that we've been discussing, and you mentioned Coppola, another thing we discussed with him.
Mm-hmm.
With the digital technology, I mean, these movies were grandiose, mm-hmm. with real flesh and blood people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could replicate 2,400 people on a computer today, but
yeah,
just amazing, and truly a huge undertaking. So there's some trivia for you about Gone with the Wind.
Yep. Back in those days, everyone worked. It's like the end of On the Waterfront. Everyone works today. These days, no, you don't need to work. We can do you on a computer now.
That's true. That's absolutely
true.
And our guest spoke to this as well. Vivian Leigh, she worked for 125 days on the film. She received about $25,000. Meanwhile, Clark Gable worked for about 71 days and received over $120,000.
Mm. Yeah. That's a huge discrepancy right there. I mean, wow.
Has that changed? I don't know.
It's
gotten better.
It's gotten better. Obviously, it's gotten better, but there's still a huge... and they always talk about how they're going to stop paying certain stars, you know, like the $20 million. You hear that every couple of years. Oh, that's not, you know, but... Now, there's still a discrepancy, but wasn't at one time a couple of years ago Cameron Diaz the highest paid actress?
Right.
I don't know if that's true anymore, but that it was at the time, I think, after Charlie's Angels or this, that she was like the highest paid actress.
Mm-hmm. I had something else in mind to say. Vincent Price auditioned for the part of Ashley.
That would have been an interesting choice. That would have been a very interesting choice. Vincent Price, wow.
And also, you mentioned Spielberg,
mm-hmm.
with Mr. Schrago. And actually, Spielberg, too, in a lot of his films, he has a preoccupation with the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And there are incredible sunset vistas in this in Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm, there are.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that was of particular influence to him,
mm-hmm.
Those images, because all the way through his films, there are people, characters looking up at the sun or looking at the sunset. And,
yeah, I mean, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., well, I mean,
Empire of the Sun.
Yeah, I mean, you just
right
go
there.
On every film. You can pick almost every film, I think, and you could... Definitely get that.
Yeah. Anyway, we thank our guests who participated in tonight's show very much. It was a real treat to have all of them, both of them on. They're tremendous writers. These are tremendous books. So if you're a fan of movies, please purchase them here on our homepage. And,
yeah, please.
You guys are in for a treat. Also, we have made another examination of a classic film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, our featured show on our homepage, so visit that. And make sure you check out our recent interviews with the director of the upcoming film The Hangover, Todd Phillips,
mm-hmm.
the movie Land of the Lost, Brad Silberling, and also...
Francis Ford Coppola.
Francis Ford Coppola, the biggie. Yeah.
The big
and
one.
James Toback. It's been a great
James
month.
Toback was... I mean, we've had really... I mean, just all those guys that we just mentioned really been... And this is, you know, after the 2-year mark, and boom, we're still.
Yeah.
I mean, we really just keep getting them. It's been incredible. Like, we keep reaching these milestones. So
yeah, it's been an honor for all of us. Yeah,
yeah, it really has.
we appreciate you guys tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you on Sunday, the full lineup of guests, and of course, next week when we examine the new classic, Michael Mann's Heat.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. But I also think AFI should do their top favorite Oscar moments of Jason O'Brien. Do a list, 100 list of that.
Yeah, I think
I don't know why.
Show.
I just thought an AFI show devoted to Jason O'Brien.
You had to end the show on that note.
I did. I'm sorry. When you brought up the AFI list, that's all I could think of was Oscar.
Okay, we appreciate everyone tuning in tonight.
Kill.
And we'll see you guys back here Sunday night.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.